Life is a series of transitions. It's a big transition to leave high school and head for college. That's a major thing in our life. We're used to living at home. We're used to functioning in and out of our family. And we get our first experience at independence and a chance to be off on our own and to succeed in something that we've set out to do. Another time of transition is when we leave college. That's a major transition. And primarily, we give ourselves to a discussion of that transition. But there are three other major transitions I would like to mention. One is that of changing, a change of job or vocation is a major adjustment. And so right after leaving college, often we have that adjustment to make. The next major adjustment is that of marriage. And so we aren't living our own life, but we're living a life in conjunction with another person. And so we lose our independence to a degree at that point, and we take on a little different role. The next major adjustment is when the first child arrives in the family. And that is probably a greater adjustment than marriage. But life is transitions, and we need to just relax and realize that's the route we're going to have to go. I think of Moses in Exodus 2. And we see the kind of transition that this man had to make in his lifetime. In verse 10, for example, we see, "And the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses, and she said, because I drew him out of the water." So Moses went to live with royalty, and he grew up in that environment. And then at the beginning of chapter 3, you see, "Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law." And so there's a tremendous transition at this point in the life of Moses from being a member of royalty to, why don't you just get the plug-in deal and it might even show up on here. Thank you. To that of herding sheep. That's a big adjustment. Nehemiah, in Nehemiah 2, we see that he shifted from being in royalty, with royalty, to get in the construction business. And there was a major adjustment. In the book of Acts, we see that they were struggling with an adjustment of the inclusion of Gentiles into God's program. And you see in Acts 10:34 the change of outlook that Peter had to take, realizing that the Gentiles were included in God's program. And so, let's see if we can plug that in, see if that'll do us any good here. Just back up a bit here and see if... Let's see, wasn't the title, "If You Graduate"? I just thought we'd have a little fun with that. I think you'll be able to see it on the wall, don't you? Sure. Great. So we've talked a little bit about Moses. We've talked about Nehemiah. We've talked in Acts about Peter having to make an adjustment. And so we, as followers of Christ, it's nothing new. We're going to have to make some adjustments. Okay, when we leave college, there are some personal transitions which we are going to have to make. Now, you're going to shake your head on some of them. You're going to say, man, does he really know what he's talking about? But these are based on counseling sessions with people and post-college people and how they feel. As far as parents, our relationship with them is going to change. We're going to find that we're more independent of them, and we're going to find that we're going to have a deeper relationship with them. Now, this is the way it should be. If it's something other than that, if we continue to maintain a high degree of dependence in our relationship with them, we're going to hurt our own life, and if the Lord leads us into marriage, it's going to really affect that. But we should have a deepening relationship because we're more a peer with our parent after we get out of college. And all of us have experienced that thing if they still look at us as a little girl or a little boy, and especially the aunts and uncles. You know, you go see them, and when I was growing up, they called me Ronnie B, you know, instead of Ron or Ronald or something. So you see an aunt or uncle, well, Ronnie B, how are you? You know, good night. But this will be a personal transition which we will be experiencing when we leave the campus. Another is that we'll shift from idealism, variety, and excitement to responsibility, routine, and mundaneness. I'm sorry about that. But we have a job. We're there from 8 to 5. We ride the same commuter bus or drive the same beat-up Volkswagen. Responsibility, routine, and mundaneness. And we have a good bit of variety. I said, well, what are we going to do this weekend? Oh, we're heading up to Estes Park. Isn't that great? Oh, yeah, here it's going to snow. And so there's variety and there's an excitement in the college and university context. But we need to realize that we're going to have to make an adjustment to this. We're going to be shifting to more responsibility. You say, well, I haven't been irresponsible. Well, that's true. But there'll be a different kind of responsibility and a growing responsibility. Third thing is there'll be more need to be a spiritual self-starter. There's not a little band of people that you're tied into called the Navigators, and they've got the rally every Friday night, and they've got touch football and so forth on Saturday, and they've got this and that. And so we're going to really have to take the initiative on our own spiritual development. Now, this sounds kind of ho-hum, but that is a critical issue, and you're going to be frustrated about that at one point or another. Four, it's going to take more work to find a peer group. On the campus, you talk to another student, any place around the campus, and you've got one thing in common, and that is you're going to school and you're at that school. And I think we fail to realize just how much that means to us as far as relating. And we get on the outside and we say, man, where is my peer group? I mean, who do I tie in with? Who are my friends? Who do I link with? So that's a very real problem, and so we're going to have to work at finding a peer group someplace. Number five is there's going to be more time to memorize, read, and study, but you're going to have to watch time management on that thing. I remember my last year in college, I thought, oh boy, when I get out of school, all of that study time, I'm going to be able to study the Bible. Wow, I'm going to be able to review my verses all, you know, a big stack of them, you know, every day, a couple times. And I got so excited about that, and it was true. But it's very easy to get off of the job, come back to where you're living, and just cool it and let the time slip through your fingers. And so all these evenings that you used to study, should have been studying, all of the weekends and so forth, you've got all this time on your hands. And then a sixth thing is to prove discipleship without navigatorship. If the navigators went out of business tomorrow, would we still be in business? I should hope so. If I were not with the navigators, I would continue to be praying about people to lead to Christ and be praying about people to disciple. And so we need it's a terrific opportunity to get a chance to prove whether or not we can really get the job done, or whether we were just in a system that was, a monkey could have been in our position in this system and it would have produced converts, you know. Or really, are we a person God can use in ministry? So those are several thoughts along the idea of personal transitions. Perhaps there are more, but those are the ones which perennially come up. So I thought we'd cover those. If one of you guys could pass out this handout, the next thing I would like to get into is our relationship to the local church. Of those I talk to, this seems to be a frustration of where we fit into the local church and exactly how that works. Very quickly, I'd like to go through those items on the handout that have to do with relating to the local church. Number one, belong to a church you believe in. There's nothing wrong with shopping around. But it's terrible for a layman to be attending a church and complaining all the time. Boy, I wish this guy had preached the Bible. It just seems like this is a bunch of dead people in this church. Or, some other complaint. But we need to find one that we can really believe in. Now, parenthetically, there's not a perfect local church, So, if you do find one, don't attend it because you'll mess it up, because you're human. But, look for one that you like. And then number two, lead in your ministry, follow and serve in the church's ministry. And so we have to shift gears. And so we've got some people on the string that we're developing friendship with that we want to see come to Christ, and we're aggressive in setting up this Bible study and all of this. And so we lead in that and we think through on this. But I've seen people with navigator background come into the local young people's group or whatever it is. And listen, they sure don't have these chairs straightened out. Okay, let's get busy. Now, let's get these straightened out. And let's see, you erase the blackboard up there. That shouldn't be up there. And just kind of come in and take over. And all these people that have been a member of that group for the last couple of years, they go, who is this character? Is he the new assistant pastor or what? Why is he taking over? But, if the chairs aren't straight, that's their problem, not ours. Number three, be patient. Ministry takes longer in the church than you're used to in the navigator ministry. That's a fact of life. So, it shouldn't be that way. Well, the way it is, but we can still get the job done. At staff conference, the Navigator staff conference in January, I guess it was, whenever it was, I was asked to give a workshop on how to relate to the local church. And I just had, as I came in, I said, okay, how many of you came to Christ through a local church? This is the U.S. area, U.S. Navigator staff people. And it ran about 50% of them had come to Christ through a local church. Don't knock the local church. Boy, God is using the local church. A lot of good stuff going on there. Tremendous things going on there. It's just a little slower pace, and so we need to realize that. Number four, praise, encourage, and bless church people rather than criticize and rebuke them. You've just known this church person for 2 months. So, there are a couple things in your life that I think I should share with you. And, they don't know what's going on. But it's amazing how people will respond to praise and, encouragement. And I said, "Boy, you did a terrific job of emceeing that meeting last night. Well, that's great. Or, you know, I really appreciated that thought you shared out of James from your reading." And people will go from success to success if we can encourage and praise them along the way. Number five, don't set out to shape up pastors, church leaders, or people older than yourself, even if they are wrong. And that's, I've seen violations of that by young people who've been around the Navigators. In the early years of the Navigators, a sailor would get off the ship, he'd come to Christ on a 3-month cruise. He'd been followed up, he was growing, he'd come back, first time he'd been in a church where he had preached the Bible. And the pastor misquotes 1 John 5:11 and 12. You know, he only knows, you know, 6 verses maybe 10. So he comes up, "Pastor, excuse me, but you misquoted that verse." You know, that's happened many times. You know. Okay, number six, take at least one responsibility in that church and do it well. Now, don't let them saddle you with 5 jobs. And be sure that it's the church that you believe in and like, but when you do gravitate in there. And I think one of the most terrific experiences is teaching a Sunday school class. Fantastic experience. Learning to communicate week after week after week biblical truth. I think it's some of the best preparation for effective ministry available. And it's serving a need within our local church. Number 7, pray for the pastor and the various facets of the church. It's pretty hard to have a bad attitude if we're praying. So focus prayer. And also, just, you know, the effectiveness that our prayers will have in changing things. And people, mainly people. Change people, everything takes care of itself. Number 8, keep in mind that the body of Christ has many parts. Don't expect everyone to acquire your strengths. Appreciate the strengths of others. Philippians 2, 3, and 4. A thing I've come to appreciate in the last 3 years or so is the role the pastor plays in visiting people with problems and sickness and all of that. Boy, I can't handle that. That just tears me up. You know, to go up to the hospital and this person is dying of cancer, and I've had some deals like that where I got an assignment. You know, go see this person, and oh boy, I'm not that member of the body. You know, this really hurts. I struggle with this. But that pastor can go up there with his warm, tender manner and encourage that person, help them. And that's needed. What if it's your aunt or uncle or grandmother or grandfather? That's when we appreciate other members of the body who can do things like that. Or those who take care of these little tiny kids in the Sunday school. You know, boy, how do they have the grace to do what they do with those kids, you know? In one department, they've got to change the diapers the whole hour. You know, that's their ministry. A little bit bigger, you know, they're running around getting into everything and climbing the walls, and this falls on the floor and that gets tipped over. And yet they're learning that God made the world and it's that He thinks they're really neat. And that's all they learn. But thank God for these people who are making contributions within the body that are different from what we are trained to do around the Navigators. Number 9, learn all you can about the way a local church functions. God may one day call you to have your most effective ministry there. The only way to learn how that thing operates is to be involved in the system. Then you know how to function in there. Number 10, plan to be consistent in your church attendance. That is most often how your commitment to Christ and the church will be measured. That seems kind of dumb, but that's the way it is. I have a younger brother who also lives in Denver. He is an accountant at First National Bank. And in his particular church, he had to attend Sunday morning and Sunday night for a number of months before they felt he was really a part of the thing. And he has since been able to write a follow-up course for their new converts. That's great, huh? But it took a while to get to that point. Now, let me just hitchhike on those points, and there are just three things, just for emphasis, I'd like to jot down here as far as relating to the church. And you can just add them on there, three more, whatever. It's really kind of... One is that the pastor is not our peer. Now, we're used to being very friendly and very open on the campus, and it doesn't mean the pastor is not friendly. But he looks on us as a member of his congregation and as a part of his flock for which he is responsible. And so there is no way that we'll have an equal relationship with that pastor. Now, if we recognize that, then when we go to him, instead of going and say, you know what we need to do with this group over here, we need to do this and this, and I'd be glad to volunteer to do this, and I could train them in that, and we're talking to him like, you know, we're in a strategy meeting for how to get the job done, and we're on equal terms. Now, we don't have the whole picture. And so we treat him with respect, and we acknowledge his position and his responsibility for the people who have marriage problems, emotional problems, problems with their children, business problems. He's counseling on all these things. There are a lot of things he's handling that we are not aware of. A second thing that I'd like to emphasize, when we are single, our reason for being in the church is sort of a worship-fellowship combination. So we go there to worship God, and we go there to be with people our own age. Often it, and rightfully so, it is a social outlet, or we look to them as our peer group, which we've been searching for. We don't want to just be relating to these pagans who are going to drag us down. We want to associate with non-Christians, but we don't want to be pulled down by them. And so we go there to worship and have fellowship with other Christians, and many of our friendships will develop through there. But further on down the road, you're going to have some additional reasons. We advise couples to think primarily of their children when they pick a church, because they are strong enough to listen to any kind of preaching and make it, and thrive even. But those children, they're just a blank piece of paper ready to be written on. And we want those impressions made on those lives to be the right ones, and that they're really Bible-centered and they come up with good biblical teaching and a positive attitude toward the whole thing. Not a highly legalistic structure. And there are evangelical churches that are just so do and don't oriented that, you know, it's tragic. And then when our family gets involved, then we want to serve. We say, well, man, I'm a part of this whole machine. What can I do to help this thing move? Now, these aren't immediate things which you're faced with, but I'm putting them into your computer anyway. And then a third thing I'd like to emphasize, which is an overlap, is that we need to earn the right to be heard. So we can just cool it, we can have our own ministry and not worry about the whole thing. And if we're really a part of that group, the day will come where we can make a change that needs to be made in the operation. We say, well, here's what I think. Couldn't we do this? And we're at a place where we can change the whole course of the direction of that church. One of the couples we're working with, they've been involved in a church that's just started, and it meets in a junior high school. Well, the husband has been asked to be on a committee to set up the constitution and the bylaws and the whole system that this church will be run on for years and years and years. Isn't that cool? So, some of these things sound mundane. I said you're shifting over from the excitement to the mundane, and a lot of life is that way. Okay, that's relating to the local church. Now I think we ought to take a look at your job. Your secular job. Sorry about that, you're going to have to go to work when you get out. And tie into secular job. Now, if you'll take a look at Exodus 20, verses 9 through 11. This is old familiar ground, but there's an interesting dimension to this that sometimes we overlook. 6 days you shall work, 6 days shall you labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord, and you shall not do any work. And then on down, 11. For in 6 days the Lord made the heaven and the earth, and so forth. But it's interesting, we usually put the emphasis on one day of rest. But it's interesting that the Bible says 6 days you shall work. And we have discovered that it helps our emotional health. Psychiatrists and psychologists are talking more and more about the need of a person to have responsibility. And that just to maintain good balance emotionally, we need to have responsibility. I think that in this recent generation of which you are a part, that we've come a long way in coming up with what the true values are in life. That it is not materialism. It is not the acquisition of things and houses and boats and fancy cars and fancy clothes. So we wear war surplus clothes and we drive old clunker buses. And, you know, there's a whole new mentality. But what I fear personally, from a biblical point of view, is that people that are your age will shift so much attention on the so-called values of life that they will not be engaged in consistent work and responsibility, and it will affect their emotional stability and health. It's interesting in Ezekiel 16:49 that one of the reasons that Sodom collapsed and became ineffective was, it said, there was abundance of idleness. There was too much leisure time. And the four-day week is here. Many corporations now have four-day weeks. You work 10 hours each of those 4 days, get in your 40 hours, and you have a three-day weekend. And I'm a little fearful what it's going to do. A second thing on the secular job, and that is money to keep us functional. Now, when we talk about discipleship, we put the emphasis on reaching people for Christ is what is important, the Great Commission, converts, disciples. Are you willing to quit pursuing the acquisition of wealth and give yourself to the Great Commission? And that is a great element in the Great Commission. That's true. But there's another dimension that particularly you get into when you are married. And that is the 1 Peter 5:8. If any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. Particularly for men, to supply enough money for the family and see that the needs are met for that family financially. And we can get a good head start on all this while we are single. I tell you, it's tremendous when a couple gets married and they have both worked and they have both have savings and they're able to start out that family with a car that will run and into a decent apartment and live under decent conditions, just the kind of environment and everything which is conducive to their getting better acquainted and they're having people in and attracting a high caliber type of person. Also, we find that couples, because they were not wise in the job selection and getting into a type of work that which will really supply their needs, when it comes to taking a trip that has to do with ministry and say, hey, listen, do you realize that next Thanksgiving we're going to have a disciples conference at Disneyland? And what we want you to do is we want you to fly out there with us and take some vacation time. Boy, I'm really sorry. We can't. We're still paying for our refrigerator. And, you know, we still are paying on our car. And, you know, we borrowed money from my brother because we were in a bind, you know. And that is a common story. And so the money keeps us functional for the cause of Christ. And I think we need to get that whole thing in balance. There's nothing evil about making money. Making money is not materialism. Meeting the needs of our family is not materialism. You see, it says the love of money is the root of all evil. It's how we use our money. And the usual way of handling money biblically, there's just a good balance. We can't nail it all down biblically, but I think the implications are there. And that is give 10% to the Lord, save 10%, and spend the rest joyfully. And that's the way you live. Now, Proverbs 22:7 says, the rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. Never buy on time. Always save up your money and pay cash. Now, if we were to hammer away on one practical thing that young couples get into, it messes up their relationship with each other and their effectiveness in the ministry, it's this thing of getting in debt. And it is not uncommon for a young couple to be $1,000 in debt. I mean, that's common. Do you know that Sears and Roebuck, they make 60% of their profit from interest on accounts, not on the markup on the product. 1.5% per month adds up to 18% a year. And so you just cannot buy on time. Save up your money and then pay cash when there's a sale and you can get a good deal. And as single people, you can get that built in right now. And I don't care whether it's a fellow or a gal. The gals spend most of the money in the marriage. And that's not poor biblical roles within the family. Food is one of the big, big expenses. Savings. Boy, I forgot what I had when I got married. I think I had $1,500 stuck away and get 5% interest or whatever it is. Savings and loan, you know. It's a good deal. Forget the mutual funds and the stocks and all that. Forget it. But put it in the savings and loan. Well, man, I was able to buy her the rings. Man, able to pay cash for those rings. And that's quite an investment. And able to get just a little furniture. You know, and we got good quality stuff. And so we were able to start out with something. But there are a lot of couples, well, how are we going to get this thing started? Oh, yeah, I'll borrow $500 from my Uncle George. And then they start the whole business off in the hole, and it's a mess. You ought to have a car that's functional so you can get around. Boy, I was glad that we had a car that was warm, comfortable. We had some chains in the trunk that we could pull out and put on that car. But we've got to think in terms of being functional in life, and we've got to have the bread to support that. And it's not wrong. A third thing about this secular job is it gives us common ground with needy people. Now let me be quick to say this, and that is that your primary ministry probably will not be, and maybe should not be, on the job. I've had businessmen tell me, I mean men who are responsible for running their business, I will never hire another Christian. Because they spend their time going around thinking they're witnessing. They're a poor testimony to everybody else because they're goofing off over here talking to somebody about Christ. They don't know how to work hard. I would like to have a greedy non-Christian working in my job because he'll be thorough, he'll be on time, he'll work hard, and he will make money for me. And the job is the wrong place to have the ministry. Now, this does not mean you will never have any ministry on the job. But what I'm saying on this point is it gives us common ground with needy people. Say, oh, you live here? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I live over such. Oh, what do you do? Oh, I do this. So you have something in common that you are laymen and you're on common ground. Now let me just, a little PS on this thing. Are you enjoying your work? Now this is something that, it's a difficult subject. In one sense of the word, all work is work, not recreation. And so we accept it as a fact of life that our job is sometimes going to be mundane, is sometimes going to be trying, is sometimes going to be difficult, is sometimes going to be inconvenient. But if we can, get into a field we enjoy. But I think we put so much emphasis on, you know, what are our values in life? You know, how could I give my whole life to this mundane job? Yeah, but that's only part of it. Great, if we can find a job we enjoy and like. My wife and I were in a study last night, and there are two physicians and their wives in here and some other people. And so I asked one of the physicians, I said, now, do you really enjoy your work? He said, I really enjoy my work. I really do. Another factor here is sometimes we have to take several jobs to find out what we do like. Now, a couple we have in another study, he got into accounting, and he studied accounting, and he worked on accounting, and he slaved and worked, and he finally even got his CPA. Then he got into a management job in some little corporation, and so he was having to manage people, and he didn't like the pressure of that thing. It was getting to him. So he took the accumulated experience and knowledge he had, moved to Denver, and he set up a little simple computer thing that runs the computer stuff for a bank. And then they take on some other work that they have some operators go in there and run it at night. And he likes it. But it may take us several years to find what we really like and what we really enjoy. So, just relax and see how that all works out. Now, a thing that we need to discuss here related to job, and that is a priority list. We'll just go rapid fire here and then discuss toward the end. A priority list for a godly husband and a godly wife. And I think as single people, we are so uninformed about a lot of stuff in advance. You know, people end up married And then they say, man, how did I get here, and where am I going, and am I on target, and all this. You need to know this. I don't think a college student needs to know it, but for both the husband and wife, the number one priority is the devotional life. If two people are close to a third person, they will themselves be close to each other. So the devotional life keeps us from getting mean and ornery and all that. Number two priority is our wife or our husband. Thinking of their needs, their interests, their concerns, time to talk with them, time to communicate. That isn't always true. Number three is the children. Now it's possible, and we see it all the time, for a husband or a wife or both to put the children ahead of everything. And it's a loser. The wife should not put the children ahead of her husband. If a husband travels a lot in his work when he is home, if he is only going to be home one day, should he spend the time with the children or with the wife? With the wife. To meet her needs and to talk with her and to be sure that she's taken care of. Because if she's happy and well taken care of, the children will get along. Now it's interesting that the average father, a recent survey I read, spent 7 minutes per week with one of his children. Tragic, huh? But we need to spend, you know, there is need to spend time with those children. Number four is the job for the man and the home for the woman. And with all the peculiar emphases that we hear today on this whole business, still, women do think the home is a pretty neat place. And there's a security and a stability about that home that really turns them on. It doesn't mean that they cannot have any outside interests or develop or, you know, that they're going to turn into a vegetable. I think the women's lib thing, there are certain things that are legitimate, like equal pay and so forth. There are other things that sounds like being in the home is drudgery. What's that song, you know? Some everyday housewife who gave up the good life for me. You know, that mentality. A couple of days ago, Betty walked in. She had just been listening to that. She said, isn't that a ridiculous song? I mean, a woman comes to a place of tremendous fulfillment in that role. You know, gave up the good life. She said, boy, I'm sure glad to get out of that old life into this. This is great. You know, with a man, the job is clear down here in priority. Now, the thing I want to point out from this list, and that is that job is going to require most of your time. So this priority list has to do with an attitude, not with the amount of time. So don't get all uptight and say, man, why am I spending 50 hours a week related to my job, or 60, travel time included and all that. Yeah, what? But that's your responsibility, and that's what keeps shoes on the kids, and cars, tires on the car, and food on the table. Then ministry is number five. No, I got those backwards. It should be the other way around. Wait a minute now. Now I'm confused. Let's see, job, ministry. With the men's side, it should be the other way around. Ministry should be next, and then job. And then with the wife, it's home, and then ministry. I said, try to get them lined up that way. But with the man, his ministry is next. If it's home and then ministry, I said, try to get them lined up that way. But with the man, his ministry is next and his job is on down there. But still, even though ministry has a higher priority than job, he's going to give more time to job. And with the wife, because the home is so interrelated with husband and children, it has a higher priority for her than ministry. And I thought that would be of help to you to see that. Do you have any questions or comments about the priority list since we're on that? Okay. Uh-huh, right. They're pretty close. You get down toward the bottom of the list and there's not much difference in priority. Okay, let's push on and then we'll kind of catch all. Okay, another thing I'd like to just put in here, marriage, question mark. And I think single people need to talk more about this whole business. Find out that they're so busy being spiritual and being disciples that they don't know the facts about this, and then they end up making some wrong decisions. And those are pretty devastating decisions. A book my wife has, I'd like to just read a little bit in here, that I think gives some of the mentality that I think is all out to lunch on this viewpoint toward marriage these days. This is written by Mrs. Norman Vincent Peale, and it talks about an encounter that she had in a university. She was asked to come into a psychology class, and it was the reactions of some of the people in there. A young woman stood up in the back of the room. She was a college senior, dark hair, handsome, sophisticated, and a little scornful. Mrs. Peale, she said, a moment ago when someone asked you what you considered the greatest career for a woman, you said marriage, right? Well, let's be honest, shall we? It's my opinion, and the opinion I'd say of most of my friends, that marriage as an institution is obsolete. We no longer believe that it's possible or even desirable to link yourself sexually with one partner in your early 20s and limit yourself to that person for the rest of your life. In fact, we think it's ridiculous. She paused, looked around at the bright young faces that filled her room. She had their attention all right. We were in a classroom, a large university, and so forth. And then it goes on down. The girl with the dark hair went on coolly. Take me, for example. There's a boy I'm fond of. We sleep together quite often. I don't think he wants to marry me, and I certainly have no intention of marrying him. He's not my first lover, and I'm sure he won't be my last. But what's wrong with this? Perhaps someday I'll decide I want children, in which case the pressures of society will probably make marriage seem advisable. But until then, I want no part of it. And even then, I don't intend to be trapped in it if it goes badly. She shook back her dark hair in a defiant gesture. We're not blind, Mrs. Peale. We look around and we see that what marriage does to people, and we don't like what we see. I think when I say these things, I'm speaking for a large part of my generation. Do you have any answer? See? But there is a lot of the mentality today, see? We are watching Love American Style. You know, I have the kind of job where evenings I'm usually hitting it, so sometimes my wife and I will take a break and watch some TV during the day or head out to the park or something. And we just caught the last of it. And here, you can see the plot. This fellow and girl had been living together for some time, and she was so concerned that he wanted to marry her. She says, oh, if we get married, it's going to ruin this beautiful relationship. But this mentality is just, you know, every turn, you get this kind of mentality on marriage. Okay, there was the question now. What in the world is she going to answer, you know? I think she does a fantastic job. Let's see. All of the bright young faces swung in my direction, and I took a deep breath. It was true. I had said that, in my opinion, marriage was the greatest career a woman could have. I had agreed that a woman might have other stimulating and important jobs, but none was so difficult and demanding, so exciting, and so potentially rewarding as a job of living with a man, studying him, supporting him, liberating his strengths, compensating his weaknesses, making his whole mechanism soar and sing the way it was designed to do. I said this because I believed it completely, but I hadn't expected a challenge quite so blunt, so harsh as this one. Modern marriage, this handsome young woman was saying, was a fraud, a mockery, and she wanted to have an answer. Yes, I said to her quietly, I have an answer, because I'm in the process of living it. I consider myself one of the most fortunate women alive. Why? Because I am totally married to a man in every sense of the word, physically, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually. We're so close you couldn't put a knife blade between us. I need him and depend on him completely. He completely needs and depends on me. We're not two lonely, competitive individuals. We're one integrated, mutual, responsive, mutual, and mutually supportive organism. And this is such a marvelous and joyous thing that nothing else in life can even approach it. It's the greatest of all adventures, but you'll never know it. You'll never even come within shouting distance of it if you maintain the attitude and code of conduct you have adopted. I don't see why not, she said. But her voice had lost some of its conviction. Why can't a man and woman relationship be just as meaningful outside of marriage as it is in? Because, I told her, it doesn't have the key ingredients. It doesn't have the commitment. It doesn't have the permanence. It can never achieve the depth that comes from total sharing, from working together toward common goals year after year, from knowing that you're playing the game for keeps. Do you think my husband and I have achieved the relationship that we have just by thinking happy thoughts or waving a wand? Don't be absurd. We fought for this relationship. We hammered it out on the anvil of joy and sorrow, of pain and problems, yes, at times, of discouragement and disagreement. But we never thought of marriage as a trap. We thought of it as a privilege, and there's quite a difference. But, you know, just, you know, it goes on. But you see, Romans 12, 1 and 2, the world can squeeze us into its own mold. But marriage is a thing which God set up, which God had in mind. He knew how we were made. He knew what we needed. He has set up guidelines and rules to make the thing work. So those are some of the key passages on it. Genesis 2, verses 18 and 24, Ephesians 5, 21 through 6, 4, Colossians 3, 17 through 21, 1 Peter 3, 1 through 7. But the reason that marriages are not working is because people are not applying the principles God laid up for the way it's supposed to be operated. And it's like any other direction within the Scripture. If we're trying to do effective evangelism, what do? We go to the Bible and say, now what does it teach about evangelizing? If we're trying to produce disciples, we go to the Bible. What does it say about how to produce disciples? When we go to marriage, we read what the psychologists say. The Bible has very clear, outstanding teaching on this. And parenthetically, you should be listening to tapes and reading books about this before you ever get designs on somebody. Navigator Headquarters has some tapes by Howard Hendricks that are out of sight on the role of the husband, the role of the wife, marriage, that whole bit. And you ought to be informed all about this stuff before you start getting an inclination that you might want to marry this certain person. And it will help you filter out who you're going to allow yourself to get interested in. And love is not an emotion. It is volitional. And that line, we've been given a wrong line for years through movies and television, that love is emotional. It doesn't mean that there is no emotion involved in love. What I'm saying is, you decide if you're going to love a certain person. And you are committed to love that person no matter what their performance is. God's quality of love is not dependent upon performance, and that is the kind of love that we should develop as strong Christians. I've jotted down two problems or two things that just from being around couples and counseling single people, things that two recommendations for you men and two recommendations for you gals. One question I have for you men is, have you learned to be truly considerate and to communicate openly? I think we've been brainwashed too that sex in marriage is the main part of the whole operation, and that's 99 and 44/100% of the whole thing. It is not. It's about 10%. Communication is one of the really critical areas. And often couples will say, oh, you know why I like her so much or I like him so much? Is because we can really talk. But men, you have a tendency to not really talk about how you feel and what you think. Women go into a lot of detail in their discussion with each other. Men do not go into a lot of detail. I find that when I go to a conference, that my wife would like to hear all kinds of detail about the trip. If she took the same kind of trip and if I were not along, I really wouldn't care about all those details. That's a difference in our makeup. So we men have to really work at communicating openly everything we can think of that would be of interest to her. But we can practice this sort of thing with our friends, other fellows. And learning to be considerate. Somehow we have built into our system, in our society, that being manly is the opposite of being considerate. And we want to be manly. But we can be very manly, but very considerate. You've seen that ad for some kind of piston rings that you see in Popular Mechanics and some of these. A big, strong guy in a bristly beard, you know. He's got this very tender look on his face, you know. That's what we can be. Secondly, is watch being too spiritual about this whole thing. I've been around enough navigator young men. Say, well, I really want to know the will of God, and I'm searching the Bible for some direction. And that's not all wrong. You know, I'm not knocking that. But there's a businessman in Oklahoma City, but when I was a single fellow, every time he'd see me, he'd say, got any interest in any girls? Well, there's nothing on the horizon right now. Well, I'll keep checking. I'll keep praying. I'd see him, you know, a few months later, and he said, how's it going? Any interest? No, I sure don't. Keep praying, you know. So we invited him to come to a conference in Georgia to speak, and he said, have any interest? Yeah. Is she here? Yeah. Now, what did he ask me? Now, most navigators say he'd probably ask you this. Do you have any promises from the Word? Are you sure it's the will of God? No, you know what he said? He said, does she turn you on? I said, yeah. And so we can be too spiritual about this business. And I've seen guys let a lot of real fine gals slip through their fingers because they were a little too slow on the draw. You know, expecting somehow God was going to float something down here. You know, it's a thing you pray about, but I'll tell you, it's such a subjective thing. It's really hard to keep objective on it. Okay, for you gals, I've got a couple thoughts here. There are a lot of principles, and I've just selected some. Do you respect him or feel superior to him? Over and over and over, we see marriages where a gal marries down. I don't know how else to say it. But the girl who has a college degree marrying the guy who dropped out of high school. The basis of a man's initial love is sexual attraction and physical attraction. The basis of the woman's love initially has to do with respect, not with physical appearance. Can she look up to him? And if he is to play the role in that marriage that he is supposed to, of leadership, and if you as the wife are to support him and adapt to his leadership, you must be able to respect him and look up to him. Usually it's best for a fellow to marry a gal who's several years younger than he. Now this is just kind of arbitrary, but I would say that the limits that you've got age-wise to work with would be to marry a girl a maximum of 2 years older than you and 10 years younger. There's kind of the boundary you've got. Depending on what age you marry will determine on how much younger a gal you could marry. But, you know, I'll bring that in under this. But if the fella has lived a little more life, traveled more, had some jobs, had some experience in this and that, he can really take the leadership and qualify for the respect of that girl. A second thing, which is a common thing, do you expect him to be a real person or a Prince Charming? And I think particularly in Christian circles, this is a problem, that we feel that a girl feels that if she marries a committed Christian, that everything's going to be taken care of. That is not true. You must work on the principles which make a marriage operate. And it means that your major lessons are going to come through conflict. It means that you're going to come to a frustration over the way you were brought up and the way you do a certain thing, and you're going to have a little argument about it. And through that conflict, you'll come to a deeper understanding. And just a few weeks ago, a wife was talking to Betty and me, and she said, you know, I was around the Navigators quite a bit. She said, I heard these beautiful stories about how God led these people together so mysteriously and so beautifully. And man, that's not the way it was with us. And they were so spiritual and everything, and I thought my husband was going to be one of these knights in shining armor. But man, he's got needs too. So I think women are more idealistic and a little bit dreamer about life, more of a dreamer about life than men. So those are just two things that I've picked out just through personal experience that I think will be of help to you fellas and gals on that issue. But you better read some books and listen to some tapes so that you can kind of get oriented. Okay, let's see. There's one other thing I'd like to show you, and then let's talk about any segment of this that you think would be of help to you or of interest. And that is Layman Ministries. When you get on the outside, what kind of ministries can you have? Okay, one is you can do your own thing. And basically, that's evangelism or growth or miscellaneous. Okay, now what do we mean? It means that you pray about people you can lead to Christ. It means you get evangelistic Bible studies going. You trust God, you blast out, and you have a ministry. Or you may decide, well, I think what I'll do is I'll get a bunch of Christians growing. And so you latch on to some people, help them grow. Or, in conjunction with some of these, you cover subjects like personal organization, priorities, you know, the things which are spiritual, but they're not as ministry-oriented. Okay, another thing you can do is you can tie in with the church. And so you can have a Sunday school class. You can have Boys Brigade. Oh, that's a tremendous ministry. Pioneer Girls. And these are both similar to Boys Scouts and Girl Scouts, if you haven't run into them. The evangelism explosion type of thing, the Coral Ridge program is in a number of churches, and you can tie into some aggressive evangelism. Now, I think that we have a little misconception about the local church and thinking that it's sort of a second-rate ministry. I think we have that built in, being around the Navigators. But, oh, to invest months and months and months in a Sunday school class and really teach some of these people and help them. To go out on a camping program with these boys and really become their friend. And they may not be very responsive at this time, but to see them years later, look back and say, boy, it was those camping trips that really brought me to Christ and to a willingness to really serve Him. Same thing with the gals. Don't underrate the possibilities within the local church. Number three is the extra church groups. And that would be like CBMC, Christian Businessmen's Committee. That would be like Bible Study Fellowship, which is primarily for women. Study groups that they have every week. What used to be called ICL, I don't think they even go by a name, International Christian Leadership. In some cities there are groups like that. But these are non-sponsored type of groups. Well, I have an extra category here, and these are the non-sponsored. So that's just somebody who has a thing going over there during the lunch hour in the office building. And you can tie into that. And the fifth thing I'd like to mention, and that's the thing that we are tied into, and that is you could tie into a NAV layman work. Now let me be very honest with you. I feel that too often people who have been around the Navigators on the college campus feel like they keep dabbling at trying to become a Navigator. And I think it's wrong. I think it's frustrating. I think we either need to decide now, am I going to go the route of becoming a Navigator, or am I going to be a layman and not try to be schizo about this thing? As I've seen fellows, gals, couples, that for years they're kind of on a string. Well, do the Navigators want me or don't they? If there's any doubt, just say, just see a Navigators and with a good attitude and head out and do one of these ministries and have a big time and produce and, you know, and enjoy life. At some later point in time, God might call you to be with the Navigators. But the Navigators is not the highest calling. Being within the will of God is the highest calling. And I could easily give the rest of my life teaching a Sunday school class every single Sunday and praying for those people and relating effectively within my community and here and there lead a person to Christ and be very satisfied. And I've seen individuals and couples who said, because I can't do everything, I'm not going to do anything. Okay, I've said more than I know already. So, What would you like to talk about for a few moments, just to wrap, okay?
As far as short range in the summer time, the church, there we are for 3 months. How would you recommend to do that?
Okay, you're not a graduating senior, right?
Not yet.
Okay. How many of you are graduating? Okay. Well, just to have an understanding with the local pastor that, you know, here I'm just going to be around for this summer, or that some associate of his, and there's really no problem in most churches with students coming and going. They aren't shook up about that at all. But it's when we get out and we have a job that they're shook up about it. Okay, what else could we talk about? Any little thing, just let's take off. John?
I'm a poor writer here, and I didn't quite get all about women's point one. You talk about like middle of the physical. Is that right? A women look at respect?
That's right. Okay. Usually the initial attraction that a fellow has for a girl is her physical appearance. Now let me just harp on that just a minute. I've seen so many girls who waited until they were almost beyond marriageable age before they lose weight, start working on makeup, start working on clothing. So you gals need to pass that word around. But that's the type of thing that needs to be worked on around the college age, so that the physical appearance is good and right. Face, figure, hair. Okay, so usually that's what the man is first attracted to. Then it gets into other things, you know, like communication. Oh, boy, I just love to talk to her. Or, you know, she's a real boost to my morale. You know, every time I'm around her, I get all encouraged. And, you know, other things. But his initial attraction will be that of appearance. For the girl, it is usually a respect for him. Now, if our appearance is bad and all that's against us. But if she hears about you being very successful at a certain thing or accomplishing a certain thing, then she looks to you with respect. And so that continues. Her basis for love for her husband will be a growing respect for him. And just one other little thing let me toss in there is you men need to learn how to make decisions. Every good decision that young husband makes in the marriage reinforces his wife's respect for him and confidence in him. And there's some other in workings that I won't all get into, having to do with her need for security and so forth. But okay, someone else?
Length of courtships.
Length of courtships. I read yesterday the longest courtship on record was, 81 years or 67? 67 years or something. I was reading it to Paul. We got a good laugh over it. I guess they were 81 when they got married finally or something. I think engagements should be very short. Courtships as long as the circumstances. But I feel that we need to be around fellows or girls, the opposite sex, enough to get acquainted with them to some degree. And when we think of courtship, it's when we're shifting in, we have a genuine interest in this person, and we're both furthering the time together and getting to know each other to the point where we can see if God is in it.
What do you look for when God
to be in it? What do you look for God to be in it? I think a place to begin is to determine what we feel God wants us to do as a man in life. And then figure out, now, what type of girl would best support that calling. Now, I don't know that we can just calculate it all out, you know, and put it in the computer and say, oh yeah, this will do it. But let me say this. I think that we need to be more concerned about what we are than what she is. And the same with girls. Am I ready to fulfill the role of leadership? Do I make good decisions? Am I courteous? Am I thoughtful? Am I communicating with the people I know? Put the emphasis there. Let's see what else I could plug in here. That's a hard question. You know, there's not a quickie answer on it. Figuring out what traits we like. Well, getting into some of those things relating to the will of God, I think that objective counsel is helpful. You know, say, well, listen, you know, I'm starting to kind of get an interest in this girl. How does that ring a bell with you? Oh, I think that's great. Or you say, you know, I think you're on two different wavelengths, it looks to me like, you know. Maybe you're just kind of enamored by her because she's such a good-looking gal. Yeah, maybe I am, you know. With me, there were certain things that I had an inkling that I needed. Like, I tend to be very serious. I'm very businesslike. So I felt that I needed a girl who was kind of fun and would kind of, you know, that, you know, she couldn't be a hard-charging, grit-the-teeth and that kind of person too, or we'd, you know, it'd be too much. I don't know what to tell you on that. That's a hard one.
A couple of things. God has to have the relationship from the beginning to the end.
Okay.
And you have to trust God for each other. And look to God for all of your real joy and happiness and things like that. And not expect things from one another.
Mm-hmm.
But if they come, then that's grace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of gravy on the side or something. Mm-hmm. Look to God for your real needs.
Mm-hmm.
And then allow your partner to just add kind of the dessert and so on.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
If he doesn't have the relationship at the beginning, and you're trying to run it all the way along, then we as foul ones, we are, you know, screwed up for one another.
Mm-hmm.
Because either we're trying to look so much out for the other person that we don't look out for ourselves, or else we're too selfish and we don't look out mm-hmm. for the other person. But God can love the person much more than you can.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you give that person to God, and just trust
mm-hmm.
him, and that's just a basis.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a good point. Any other thoughts that you could help us with? Yes? Another thing I would say is be around the person enough to really get to know them and have them get to know you. And that sounds like such a non-spiritual thing, but a lot of time to get acquainted and talk about this and this and this. Talk about everything. Talk about your family backgrounds. Talk about where you grew up, what you're interested in, what you do, what you've been doing. And all of that, and you start getting some inklings. Now, see, you can do that casually in any group. Just start to get acquainted with people in that group. Until you say, boy, I really enjoy being around her, and I, you know, that sort of thing. Okay?
Maybe one final thing. It may sound like kind of gee whiz, but, you know, as far as you know, just a rough idea of somebody's faith and their walk with God.
the same basic commitment to Christ. Now, another thing for you men, you don't need a high-powered spiritual gal. You just need one who loves God. So all the rest can be built in. And now, if you gals are pretty far along spiritually, it's going to be real tough if you marry somebody who is back down the road behind you quite a ways spiritually. That'll be one of those areas of respect for him. It'd be great if you could have respect for him in the spiritual dimension. But also it might be something that you can talk over, and he says, boy, I really do want to grow. And so he gets tied into somebody who can help him grow. The girl can not help the fellow grow. That is a loser. Sometimes the fella can help the girl grow, but it doesn't work that other way around. Because she has to assume a dominant leadership role. Stan? Does the girl need to have vision as far as the ministry or same as his calling? Basically, she just needs to love him. Because she can get the calling straightened around real easy. But there has to be, the reason I summarized his comments by basic commitment to Christ, is see, does she really want to do what Christ wants? See, that's the issue. Whether or not she's called to Taiwan, and I also am called to Taiwan, that really doesn't matter.
Being called to the husband,
the man, that's the woman's role. Yeah. Well, Jim Downing used to counsel a lot, well, he probably still does a lot, and he said, well, I talked to the man about whether it's the will of God or not. I talked to the girl about whether or not she loves him. I said, that may not sound right to you. It may sound too, but see, the man must get the vision and the direction. The girl must just say, I respect him, I love him, and it looks like God is leading in this. Great. Okay, let's call it quits. If you want to stick around and ask a couple more, you can.